From Chaos West, I'm Scott Horton. This is Anti-War Radio. Y'all, welcome to the show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm about as happy as I can be to be back on Chaos Radio in Austin, broadcasting from Chaos West here in Los Angeles. Go to thestressblog.com and check out a picture of the view from Chaos West. It ain't so bad. All right, yeah, so I'm Scott, and I guess probably some of you are wondering what the hell is going on. I've been off the radio for a month and a half. Moved out to Los Angeles. Nobody but me is sure why. So I have a big announcement, but I can't tell you what it is. Sorry. For those of you who've been wondering, you're just going to have to wait. But as George Bush, our former president, would say when talking about killing people, it's hard work. We're making progress. So, have heart. There's a purpose and a rhyme behind this reason, or strike that, reverse it, or something like that. Everything is proceeding as I have foreseen. So take heart. But I'm glad no matter what happens, there's always Chaos Radio for me. And, well, it's sort of like the house I grew up in, is how it feels to me. So, I sure am happy to be here. I got a great show lined up for you today. Stephen Clemens will be here, as well as James Bamford, and, Gareth Porter will be on the phone to give us a short update. I know you guys read Gareth Porter at antiwar.com/Porter. He writes two or three times a week, great news analysis, investigative journalism, and sometimes an opinion piece or two as well. And I'm sure you read his articles, and I'm sure you've been listening to the interviews that have been being recorded and posted up at antiwar.com over the last few weeks, and particularly my last one with Gareth, which was from, what, just last Thursday or something, about General Petraeus and General Odierno's insubordination and attempts to end run the President of the United States in order to stay in Iraq longer. So we'll have an update from Gareth on that extremely important story. There's really nothing more important, is there, than uppity generals in this land where, despite everything, we still presumably maintain civilian supremacy over our military. I guess those days are coming to an end. But anyway, so Gareth will be here. James Bamford, of course, will be discussing the security state. And Steve Clemens, Middle East policy, so, and the Israeli election. So should be a good show for you. If you like, go to the front page of thestressblog.com. That's my blog, Stress. Thestressblog.com. And if you look for the green writing on the right-hand side of the front of the page there, you can follow those instructions to join up the IRC Anti-War Radio chat room and hang out with the guys in there. I have mine open, but it's way off to the left where I can barely see it. I'm going to have to figure something out about that. Never could talk and read at the same time anyway. Unless I was just talking what I was reading, but that's different. So anyway, I guess if you're new to the show, I should explain why this show. I am a libertarian, and I believe in natural rights, and I want to see a coercion-free society and all that. But mostly, I just hate being lied to. I just hate it. And for some reason, I guess that's my one talent, is I'm pretty good at seeing through the lies and remembering why it was that what they said last week makes what they said this week not true, or the other way around. And so that's really my motivation, is hatred. I hate the people who run our government, and I cannot stand the lies that they try to tell me in order to get my... I don't know why they even think they need my permission anymore, but they do try to lie to me every day to get me to consent to their most despicable, murderous behavior. So my role is telling you why they're lying, and hopefully arming you with the information that you need to debunk their lies to others. And so, you know, that way we can be free and all that cool stuff. Also, I think it's most important that libertarians figure out a way to communicate their ideas to people on the right and the left, so that basically a belief in liberty, in actual freedom, can replace so-called moderation, which is actually extremism, in the political center. The so-called moderates agree with the right and the left about every terrible thing they should do to everybody all the time. There's nothing moderate about them at all. The centrists are the most extreme faction, as wishy-washy as they are and as hard to define as they are. These are people who are for everybody's war, domestic or foreign. And, you know, if it seems to me, if you have national socialism on the right and international socialism on the left, that liberty doesn't really fit in there, or I guess it does fit as what they call, you know, moderation in the center, splitting the difference between those two statist philosophies and policy prescriptions. So I think libertarianism should be the real center, those who really believe in freedom and limitations upon state power. And so, you know, in order to forge that realignment, in order to make that true, I think libertarians have to set the best example, not just about on talking about libertarianism, but actually covering the issues that are most important and from a libertarian perspective in order to kind of, you know, show other people how that works, particularly on the war issue. Libertarians stay anti-war when liberals are in power. And so I hope that I can set a good example for peacemongers everywhere and set a good example for libertarianism, in fact, by being such an intractable opponent of the war party. And maybe it won't do any good, but that's why I'm here anyway. So I hope you dig it. Yeah, how you like that? Hey, there's a phone number here. I'm not sure how I'm going to work in all the news stories I want to cover today and all the issues I want to cover today, plus all the interviews that I have for you today. I'm going to try to cram it all in there somewhere, but if you guys want to call in the show, I should give out the number. Actually, you shouldn't call in yet because I'm not even... I don't have it set up right. You'll have to give me a minute, but maybe here after, you know, during the break, I'll get that set up so we can take some calls. I've gotten a lot of nice emails. I guess that's how I really should have started this show. Thank you to everybody who, you know, actually cares and wants this. So you're the demand to my supply, and without you, there would be no such thing as this. So thank you very much. And, you know who you are. And even those who didn't send emails, but, you know, still feel the same way, yeah, you know, I like you guys too. Okay, so the most important issue of the day, well, really is the Israeli election, but we cover that with the Steve Clemens interview. So the other most important issue of the day is the stimulus, so-called stimulus package, and the debate over economics in this country. We're in a terrible position in having the Republican right in the position of, as sole opposition to the party in power. The Democrats now in the position the Republicans were in for so long, controlling both houses of Congress and the presidency. And of course, you know, the doctrine of the Constitution limiting any part of the government's authority is long dead, so having a bunch of unitary executive fascist so-called conservatives on the Supreme Court is not going to be any kind of check. They might as well be Democrats, too, as far as their belief in unlimited power goes. But we're in real trouble when we don't have anyone to dispute what the Democrats are doing except a bunch of Republicans. And Barack Obama is absolutely right when he said in his press conference yesterday, those Republicans who got us into this mess, who created all this terrible problem that I'm inheriting, it's pretty thin coming from you that what I'm doing is wrong. Of course, if he thought about it a little bit further, he would recognize that all he's doing is more of exactly what they were doing that got us into this mess in the first place. And here's where the libertarians really need to shine, because we are not pro-torture. We did not support the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, etc., etc. We are opposed to the warfare state. We've been opposed to deficit spending this whole time. People want to say that the doctrine of, you know, libertarian capitalism is what caused this problem, even though America's really never had anything like a free market since Hamilton got the Constitution ratified, and we've lived in a somewhat democratic, soft, fascist state since, you know, the turn of the last century, since Theodore Roosevelt, at least. And yet it's, and here's the libertarians are the only people who actually want there to not be a central bank. The libertarians are the only ones who opposed the actual cause of our problem this whole time. So it's most unfortunate, but it is true. It's just a reality we have to deal with, that libertarians are getting the blame for this crisis. In spite of all evidence, libertarianism is the rich white man's anarchy. Even though it's right in front of your eyeballs and mine, it's actually liberalism and conservatism and the Democratic and Republican parties. They're the rich white man's anarchy. If libertarianism was the rich white man's anarchy, where are all the rich libertarians? Libertarianism is the average schmuck's anarchy. And that's why most Americans have never even, you know, heard the term. Seems like if libertarianism was about letting these most evil corporate chieftains get away with bloody murder, they would be our biggest supporters. So maybe there's a, you know, possibly that's a clue that there's a flaw in the theory. But here's the thing. You might be a liberal or a leftist, and you might completely disagree about libertarian economics. And you might think that in a recession or a depression, that it's absolutely vital that the government do something to help the unemployed and this, that, and the other thing. And I, you know, might disagree with that, but we could completely leave that to the side. We completely leave that to the side. Whatever you think the prescription for the problem is, as far as, you know, ameliorating the effects of the recession, we could leave that argument to the side. But I think it's most important for everyone in this whole society. We've got to finally get our head around this. It's not that complicated. I mean, they sell it to us as this big complicated thing that never you mind, just let the experts worry about it. But it's really not. And if you're a liberal or if you're a conservative, a leftist or, you know, a right winger or whoever you are, you ought to be able to, first of all, understand what I'm telling you now or fixing to. And it ought to not really clash with your ideology. It's just the truth. It's something that's not really ever explained. And that is that the recession is not a big dip in productivity and consumption and economic output from the status quo, from the norm. The recession is the result of gravity coming due, the laws of physics coming due to restrain irrational exuberance, to restrain, it's the market preventing the government from making a bubble so big that the dollar is just worthless. The bubble itself is not all things being equal. The bubble is the distortion. Wow, we're riding high, times are good. Well, if it's too good to be true, it's too good to be true. It was an artificial high. And Lou Rockwell on the show last week made the great analogy. It's like having a great time being drunk and then having a hangover the next day. We recognize, most of us, don't we, that it's the damage is done when you're getting drunk. The hangover is just the consequence that you have to suffer through. Now the question is, do you want, you know, the hair of the dog, or, you know, drink some orange juice and eat some pancakes and go get some exercise? One is the hair of the dog path. If you stay on that path, is the path to alcoholism and delirium tremens, man. Destruction. At some point, you gotta go ahead and, you know, let your buzz go, deal with your headache, eat some aspirin, and get back on ride again. Get, not, you know, hold off getting drunk for a couple more days. That's the reality. But to hear the entire media, with the exception of a few twisted right-wing, you know, pro-torture imperialist warmongers who really don't know what they're talking about and can't really make the argument against it, with the exception of those unnotable people, the entire media and the entire, certainly, Democratic establishment basically starts with the assumption that everything was fine until the recession started. And now the role of government is to make up for the difference between where we were and where we are. By, as Paul Krugman says in the New York Times, there's a $3.9 trillion hole in the economy, and government has to fill it. But that is based on the false assumption that history began last September. That the beginning of the recession was the Big Bang. And so I think most people, even if you have no education about how fractional reserve banking works, how the Federal Reserve, you know, goes about manipulating the interest rates and artificially making money cheaper than it really would be in a market setting to borrow, and how that creates the bubble, if you don't understand all those mechanics, you can still see, can't you, that it makes no sense. For example, the president yesterday to say, the Republicans got us into this mess with all their deficits. I inherited this deficit. It's their fault, not mine. I just got here, he said. But then his prescription is more deficit. And in fact, double it, triple it, quadruple it. Bloomberg News is counting up all the bailouts and stimulus plus the guarantees, the taxpayer, wink, wink, guarantees on loans by these big banks, and they're calculating that we're at $9.7 trillion. The American taxpayer is on the hook for $10 trillion worth of bailout and stimulus in order to protect us from the result of the government's policy, which was in the Greenspan years. I mean, remember, just back a few months ago, when you thought the war was free. Remember thinking that the war was free? Wow, we get to have wars all over the world and they don't cost us anything. I even got a tax cut. Remember believing that for the last half a decade or more? Well, it turns out that's not true. It turns out that they were creating a bunch of extra money, new money, to pay for those wars. It was a war bubble. And that war bubble, of course, also manifested in housing and in the stock market. But it was because Alan Greenspan and then Ben Bernanke put their foot on the gas. They, you know, put a new notch in the gearbox, shifted up to sixth, and started cranking out money, making it artificially cheap, making it seem to businessmen that there are excess savings in the market, and now is the time to borrow those savings. Right? Because if there are excess, quote unquote, savings from a banker's point of view, it's time to lower the interest rate and loan out more money. But this money wasn't coming from savings. It was coming from a magic wand and from debts to China and Korea and Japan. And now the Democrats are telling us that all this spending, all this terrible waste from the Bush government, which is in fact the biggest government in the history of the entire solar system, which is in fact, what, triple in size or two-thirds again in size, what Bill Clinton left George Bush. when the Republicans controlled the Congress almost the entire time they controlled both houses, and with George Bush in the presidency and right-wingers in the Supreme Court, Bill Clinton had the first trillion-dollar budget in, I think, 98, 99. We're now over $3 trillion a year, this empire. And now the Democrats are saying that's what caused our problem. That's why we need to keep doing exactly that. We're in a deep pit. We've got this really sharp shovel, but you know what would be better? A jackhammer. It'd be better to get some super hot laser that can just turn this dirt to ash and just bore right through to China. And that's how we'll dig ourselves out of this mess. When in fact, all that artificial money was fooling people into making bad decisions, and now the laws of gravity are coming due. That's all it is. The laws of the market. And the market isn't magic. The market is not an existential, invisible hand. That's a pretty crappy metaphor. The market is just a singular term for millions and millions, and in fact hundreds of millions, billions of people making decisions about their property. Whether to save it, whether to spend it, whether to invest it, and on and in what. That's all the market is. And the market is saying, this house isn't worth $300,000. Who are you kidding? The market is saying, the guys that run the Chase, Citigroup, Morgan Guarantee, Bank of America, Trust, whatever the hell it's called now, all merged together and bankrupt as hell, don't know how to run a business. They made a bunch of bad investments. Now, here's the thing that especially frustrates me when arguing with liberals. Don't you guys hate Citigroup? What about JP Morgan Chase? And these are some of the most evil people in the world. These are the fascists. Citigroup and the Chase Manhattan Bank, these are the people who built the American Empire. The State Department of the American Empire. Because after all, you know, America started out in tiny little colonies and tiny little State Department. The actual Imperial State Department of this country was built on top of the Standard Oil business network. This is their empire. And now, everybody wants to abandon capitalism right at the good part. When the Citigroup goes out of business, they say, oh, well, laissez-faire capitalism caused this problem. We got to abandon it now. I say, you know what? If you want to abandon it, if you're determined to abandon capitalism, fine. But can we at least just wait until all these horrible banks go out of business? And maybe we get people who can make smart business decisions and not invest all their clients' money in a bunch of crap? No, we have to save the most evil people on earth. Who say, oh, no, Scott, you don't understand. Capitalism tends toward monopoly. Really? It seems to me like it's government that's saving these people. It seems to me like capitalism has a far better turnover rate than elections. And especially when you live in a world with a government central bank and massive booms and busts, they get caught up in their own mess. I was reading an article over at LouRockwell.com the other day. It said, the masters of the universe didn't plan this. There's some people think, oh, yeah, they created this crisis in order to do this, that, the other thing. Oh, no. The masters of the universe finally got theirs. That's what happened here. The masters of the universe couldn't pull it off any longer, is what happened here. And so good. All this collapse. People say the market is seeking the bottom. Where's the bottom? Well, we don't really know yet. But government's not going to tell you where it is. And they're not going to help you by artificially saying the bottom's here. Let's inflate the bubble again with trillions of dollars of new money and get our economy back to the wonderful fakery of last year. That's actually not going to help you. It's only going to put people to work doing things that are unproductive or at least less productive than would be if people were distributing the resources themselves, assuming that the consequences for their bad decisions are internalized. Of course, if you run the Chase Bank, J.P. Morgan Chase now, or if you run Citigroup or any of these banks, other than Merrill Lynch, I guess, you know you have a bailout. In fact, Merrill Lynch, they thought they had a bailout. And they figure they can make as many bad loans as they want. They can put all their money in AAA-rated mortgage bundle packages and whatever, and they don't care. Because they know that the government is going to save them. They know that the government is going to use the Federal Reserve to create new money and use the power of the Congress to borrow more money and save them from the consequences of their bad decisions, which is what, of course, helps them make such bad decisions in the first place. But anyway, picture a line going, you know, steadily, not too sharply up from the left side of your, you know, eye range to the right. A steadily growing economy. Then the Fed comes, sticks a straw in, and blows, and makes a big bubble in that economy. All the people on top of that bubble say, we're rich, we did it. Finally, the bubble pops. It may even go down the level of your little slowly increasing line graph here. Might actually even go down a little bit during that recession. But ultimately, what's really happening is you're just going from irrationally exuberant to reality. You're not going from reality down into the depths of hell unless the government stops us. This is coming back to reality. That's why they call it a correction. So, you know, I guess I don't tell all this in the right order and I'm kind of out of practice, but the thing of the matter is, it's the government intervention. And never even mind Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and never even mind, you know, pressure group lobbying for the government to force banks to make more bad loans and that kind of thing. The ultimate problem here is the government control over the currency. Remember how when you're a kid, you get the money and they tell you at school, yeah, well, the government creates enough money so we all have it to trade around and buy stuff with and whatever represents the wealth that we earn and those kinds of things. Well, there's a lot more to it than that. Actually, the government is stealing from you every time they print a new one of those. And they're driving up the prices, usually in their friend, in their politically connected friends' businesses at your expense. And by creating so much new money out of nothing, government causes the bubble. They cause the crisis. Now here we're stuck, literally in a society of full-grown adults, hundreds of millions of us, who apparently, and I only know this from, you know, reading as much as I can, and watching even news on TV, and pretty much everyone agrees. The government has got to spend trillions of dollars to stimulate the economy now. And it's just hokum. And all it can do is get us in worse trouble. I mean, you might even, again, you might still argue, hey, Scott, when tens of thousands of people are being thrown out of work because of the government's created boom-bust cycle, still, what are you going to do? You got to give these people welfare benefits in order to, you know, so they don't go hungry and whatever during the transition period here from irrational exuberance to reality. And you know what? I disagree, and I think it's actually counterproductive to do such things. But whatever, that's fine. We can disagree on that. You know, big fan of unemployment insurance. Hey, that's why they make you pay into it, right? Whatever. That's fine. I don't want to argue about that. All I'm telling you is the boom-bust cycle is caused by the government's central bank. They're not the solution to it. They're the cause. As simple as that. And of course, you know, I should talk more about the foreign policy angle of this. This is the name of the game. Since the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, or signed into law in 1913, really created in 1914, America was at war in Europe by 1917, and we've basically been at war ever since, with a few exceptions, maybe a year here or there. And the name of the game is central banking and empire. That's how it all works. So you don't have to be a libertarian to dig this. In fact, I met a leftist the other day, who I actually just overheard him explaining to someone else, The big coup happened. The beginning of the end was back in 1913 when the bankers got their Federal Reserve Act passed, gave them control over the creation of the currency. And he wasn't a libertarian. He wasn't a right-wing John Bircher. He was a leftist. And he was saying, you see what happens when the bankers and the government get together to control the creation of the currency, they screw the rest of us. That's all. Doesn't matter what your ideology is, that's just true. That's just true. And to think that giving all the power to the people who created our crisis in order to solve it, that is the central bank, never mind Republicans and Democrats, giving them the power to do what? To stimulate the economy, create a bunch more money is only going to do one thing. It's going to cause massive inflation. It is massive inflation. It's going to cause rise in prices, and then people will demand price caps and price controls, maybe wage and price controls. And, of course, that'll just cause shortages because you're not going to sell at wholesale for less than you're allowed by if you are making bread and the money is depreciating day by day by day, and it takes you 10 new American dollars to make a loaf of bread and ship it to the store, but the store is only allowed to charge 6 for it, and therefore only going to be able to pay you 5 for it, then you're just not going to ship the bread. It's as simple as that. You're going to not make the bread. Price controls don't work. It's what economically ignorant people do when their government has caused massive inflation, and this is the road we're on. There's a pseudo-rally in the dollar now, only because of the onset of the recession. But once all this spending hits, you're going to have a massive inflation, then you're going to have price controls, then you're going to have shortages, then you're going to have riots, and then you're going to have another 10 degrees cranked up on the police state. Bad policy. And I can see it coming now. You can quote me now. I already sent off the bumper sticker to be made. Paper money. Bubble, recession, stimulus, inflation, price controls, shortages, riots, police state. In fact, you want to know how rickety our economic system is here in the U.S. This is from an episode of The Simpsons back during the good times. The government school teachers were on strike, and this is all it took for Bart to cause a bank run.
What do you mean the bank is out of money?
Insolvent? You only have enough cash for the next 3 customers!
Hey, what's this? Just a second here. No, I don't have your money here. It's in Bill's house and Fred's house.
Hey, what the hell are you doing with my money in your house, Fred?
So why doesn't a recession happen in a couple of weeks or a month or so? Well, the reason it doesn't happen in a couple of weeks, you don't have a quick boom, a quick recession almost before you can see it, is because the banking system, in order to validate the process, keeps inflating. It's not a one-shot proposition. In order to keep Chrysler and the other companies afloat, they have to continue to increase the money supply, continue to inflate, so it's allowed, for example, Chrysler to buy more, finance their inventory more as prices keep going up. They then have to get more bank credit to keep the thing going. It's like staying one step ahead of, if you're a heroin addict, let's say, increasing the dosage is staying one step ahead of retribution, one step ahead of total collapse by getting a larger dose as they keep the whole inflationary boom afloat.
All the leaves are brown and the sky is gray. I'll be for walk on a winter day. I'll be at a wall keep my body landing.
Alright, everyone, welcome back to Anti-War Radio. I'm Scott Horton, and introducing my favorite regular guest, Dr. Gareth Porter. He's an independent historian and journalist, writes for IPS News. You can find all his IPS stuff at antiwar.com/Porter. Welcome to the show, Gareth.
Hello, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Hey, listen, we had this discussion last week about General Petraeus and General Odierno's insubordination, their attempt to pressure Barack Obama to keep American soldiers in Iraq longer. And you have a new article. It's up right now at antiwar.com/Porter. Following up on this story, what can you tell us here?
Well, this is a fascinating twist in the story, really quite a surprise to me, that I actually had an email from a military source close to Petraeus, who clearly was acting on Petraeus' behalf, responding to the earlier story that you just referred to, and essentially complaining about the story, saying that it was inaccurate and that Petraeus wanted to set the record straight, he said he wanted to talk to me. So I called him, and we had a rather long conversation, the gist of which was he insisted that Petraeus was not unhappy with the meeting that had been held on January 21st in the White House with Obama, Gates, and Mullen, as well as Odierno by video conference. But in fact, according to this associate of Petraeus, the general was very happy with the discussion, happy with the way it went, said that what was happening was that Obama was discussing with them options and risks. And so that was the result of that call. But the next day then, I received another call from him saying that he had a story for me. He was going to leak to me an account of that meeting from Petraeus, which would set the record straight. And he then dictated a statement, a sentence, a rather long sentence, which said in essence that we, meaning Odierno and Petraeus, were asked to provide the president a three sets of studies with projections, assumptions, and risks for three drawdown options: 16 months, 19 months, and 23 months. So, so that was what he was giving me, and wanted me then to publish a story about. Well, I asked a bunch of questions. I asked him to go back to the general and get some more details, this being obviously a very partial fragment of whatever happened. He did claim that he did that and came back to me and said that that was all the information he could get. So I tried to confirm this with people who I'd talked to and people who were at the White House who I had not talked to yet. I spent the rest of the week trying to get some confirmation, and finally, yesterday, I did get a denial from the White House of this story, a very explicit denial saying, no, the president did not request the three studies as claimed, that this was not true. So that's the essence of the story that I wrote. What I was trying to do was to make sense of this, to interpret really what Petraeus was up to. Why was he doing this? What purpose did it serve?
All right, now hold on a sec, because I just want to make sure that we're on the same page here.
Yeah.
Basically, what you're saying is everybody agrees there was a meeting, and as you reported it, the generals were trying to talk Obama into a longer, or at least looking into possibly longer withdrawal plans than a 16-month plan.
Right.
Then Petraeus has deliberately leaked this same story, only a completely different spin on it, to McClatchy newspapers, saying that it was Obama who asked, or implying basically, oh yeah, Obama wanted us to look into these longer withdrawal periods, when really he was just saying, you guys go ahead, and that this makes a big difference, because the generals are trying to basically spin what the president is up to, and I don't know,
that's
there.
Right. That is exactly right. I mean, this is an effort to spin the meaning of that meeting in a way that portrays Obama as having essentially made a major move away from his 16 months, the commitment to the 16 months withdrawal plan, to the alternatives that have been suggested, or I should say, just two alternatives that have been suggested by the military, a longer time frame. Now, you know, the essence of what he did, it's very interesting. I mean, he did not, I cannot say and did not say in my story that Petraeus was providing a sentence which was false. What I am saying, however, is that he was giving me a misleading sentence, in the sense that the implication was that this was something that was requested by Obama at that meeting. Now, the question, of course, is, if that were the case, then why didn't he simply say that? Why didn't he give me a sentence saying, the president requested that we, blah, 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 blah. Instead, he said, we were asked, use the passive voice. That's a dead giveaway that the reality was different from the implication that was clearly intended here. And as I point out, Nancy Youssef, the McClatchy reporter covering the Pentagon, was also given this story. She was given the exact same sentence, except for one word that was missing from the sentence that I was given. And she published the story pretty much straight, although she did add some details which cast some doubt on it. And she said that aides to Obama had told her that the president had informed them after he took office, meaning presumably the 21st and after, that he still favored the 16-month commitment. He still stuck by his 16-month commitment, but he would listen to the military and see what they had to say about the risks involved. That is a very different story from the president coming into the meeting and saying, okay, I want you to give me these three plans, 16 months, 19 months, and 23 months. Now, I have a strong suspicion that what happened here is that after the meeting, Gates requested that they provide these three specific studies. We have no idea on whose authority. We have no idea what it means, you know, in terms of any presidential viewpoint. But I think, you know, you have to suspect at this point that that did not happen in the meeting, that it was not said by the president.
Well, and there was an article in the Washington Post on Saturday, I think maybe it was Sunday, that basically, I think it said was based on embargoed interviews with Odierno from last December or whatever. But basically it told a story, and this, I guess, was part of what you were referring to in your last article. It told the story of how Odierno basically went around Pace and Casey, the commander of the head of CENTCOM and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at the time, in order to basically go an end run around through this retired General Jack Keane to the White House in order to get the surge done and
right.
the
this
increase
is,
in troops. And it basically also makes clear in there that he doesn't want to leave yet.
Right. I mean, this is really about the way in which, I mean, this series of stories by Tom Ricks is building up Odierno in particular and trying to make him into the author of the surge in Iraq, contrary to what a lot of evidence suggests from Woodward and others, that in fact he was not the primary author. But in any case, the key thing that you're pointing to is that there was an end run around the chain of command, both by Odierno and Petraeus, clearly, during 2007 and 2008, particularly 2007, because it was at that point the Joint Chiefs and William Fallon, the CENTCOM commander, were doing their best to try to draw down troops from Iraq, believing that this was the best course for the United States, for the U.S. military. And it was Keane who was very close to Vice President Dick Cheney, who basically intervened and got Cheney to talk to Bush and got then Bush to agree to protect Petraeus from the effort by people who were actually his superiors, specifically Fallon, to protect Petraeus from their efforts to basically change the mission and to accelerate the pace of withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. And so that's a very interesting and important case in which, you know, there was connivance between people in Washington and the field commanders to get around the chain of command.
All right, everybody, that's Dr. Gareth Porter, IPS News. You can find all his archives at antiwar.com/Porter. Thanks very much for your time on the show today, Gareth.
It's a pleasure, as always.
Y'all, if I can go off a little bit more about economics, I just want to recommend some books to you. First of all, The Case Against the Fed and What Has Government Done to Our Money by Murray N. Rothbard. Both of those are very small, very short reads, and will certainly get you up to speed. Tom Woods has a new book called Meltdown that I haven't read yet, but I'm sure it's great because Tom Woods is great. But Rothbard will give you the basics. It's really all you need to know is in The Case Against the Fed. Also, of course, G. Edward Griffin's The Creature from Jekyll Island is a great history of the central bank, the people who run it, and their various machinations in the building of the American empire. And I'd like to also recommend William Grierder's book, Secrets of the Temple, which is the Washington Post version of The Creature from Jekyll Island, frankly. And it's a story, it's the story of Paul Volcker's term in the late 70s and the early 1980s when he raised interest rates up to, what, 25% or something in order to put a stranglehold on all the inflation that the government had created in the 70s, trying to stimulate the economy after the big recession from the Vietnam War bubble. Anyway, Grierder tells the story of Paul Volcker's war against inflation. And if you already get a good Austrian grounding in economic theory, reading some Rothbard before you crack into Grierder, it'll certainly be a better read. I have to tell you, you really got to be dedicated to want to read Secrets of the Temple. It is, I made myself finish that damn book. Oh, I would promise myself I wouldn't curse anymore. It is that kind of a book, though. It's horrible. It's so, it was a chore to get done. But some very important learnings in there as well. Yeah, especially read Rothbard. Go to Mises.org. And again, you could be a leftist or liberal or a conservative, Republican, right-wing, whoever the heck you are, and you could still understand that it's the artificial increase in the money supply, the conspiracy, frankly, between the government and the banks to create new money and loan it into circulation that causes the boom and bust cycle that we are now just at the beginning of the bust end of.
But they're not exactly winning me over with these lousy production values here.
Yeah, me either. Anyway, so there's that. That's all I got to say about that. Also, I just thought it was funny that Walter Jones, remember Freedom Fries Jones, he turned against the war. He now is introducing a law to make it a crime, an actual felony, to lie us into war. But then apparently in the bill he cites Bill Clinton and the phony mass graves of the Kosovo War, which of course is true. I wonder, why did he leave out Bill Clinton's bombing of Iraq in the name of weapons of mass destruction when we all know that Madeleine Albright was ready to certify Iraq weapons of mass destruction free in 1997? Operation Desert Fox, which Bill Clinton named after Rommel the Nazi, and which he launched on the day that the full House of Representatives was to begin debating the articles of impeachment against him, was in December of 1998. Long after Madeleine Albright was at least prepared before she was stopped by the administration from certifying Iraq weapons of mass destruction free. So how about Bill Clinton would be a felony under that standard as well? And then for some reason, I'm not really sure, and I didn't actually read the whole thing, I just read an article about it, but apparently Freedom Fries Jones completely left out the lies that got us into the war in Iraq. Never mind Somalia. almost got us into a war in Georgia. No. Never mind the lies of the Bush administration. Never mind Dick Cheney saying that his intelligence says that they have, in fact, reconstituted nuclear weapons. Even though Iraq, of course, never had nuclear weapons to constitute in the first place, they had reconstituted them. How about that for a lie? How about they have warehouses full of biological and chemical weapons, VX and sarin, mustard and all kinds of nerve gas, anthrax, Bush pronounced uncharacteristically correctly. Can you do that? I'm not much better at grammar than he is, unfortunately. But anyway, it is a crime to lie us into war. Clearly, it's the kind of thing that ought to get people impeached and removed from office and locked in dark dungeons, to lie this country into war. But I guess Jim Jones, not Jim Jones, that's somebody else, Walter Jones, has a point in trying to introduce a law to actually make it a felony, because there are no teeth in the Constitution. I guess they just assumed that any president who would dare lie us into war or try to would immediately be impeached and removed by the Congress. Or maybe they created the Constitution just for the purpose of presidents being able to lie us into war. I guess people could argue about that. But, well, let's see. They lied us into the war of 1812 through 14, which was just a naked attempt to steal Canada. They lied us into the war with Mexico, claiming that the Mexicans had attacked American soldiers on American soil, which was a lie. And as pointed out by Abraham Lincoln, who then basically maneuvered the South into firing the first shots at Fort Sumter, where he had no business maintaining federal troops after they had seceded from the Union. And then, let's see, they lied us into the Indian Wars, saying, what, that the Indians started it? Or I don't know how convincing that was, but, you know, I guess it's a lot like being an Israeli and blaming the people of Gaza for starting a war with you, right? And then, of course, I don't know if they even bothered lying to steal Hawaii, but they certainly lied the American people into the Spanish-American War, pretending that the Spanish had attacked the battleship Maine off the coast of Cuba when they knew it was simply an accident, a fire that had spread to the armaments and caused them to explode and destroy the ship and sink it. But that was used to lie us into war with Spain, which our government then used as the opportunity to steal Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the Philippines, and start America's path toward a real international empire. And of course, they lied us into World War I with the Lusitania, which was deliberately sent into waters full of U-boats, and then with the Zimmerman telegram, which was purported to be a credible threat that Germany was going to help Mexico reinvade and take back the Southwest. Yeah, right. And then, of course, you have the greatest treason ever committed in the history of humanity, and that is FDR's treason at Pearl Harbor and the deliberate death by high explosives and saltwater drowning of 3,500 young men in order to trick the American people, who were 80% opposed, into going to fight a war in Europe, a war that benefited the Soviet Union more than anybody else. And then, of course, they lied to us through the whole Cold War, saying that the Soviet Union was a threat, even though they knew. They admitted in their internal documents that they knew it wasn't. As Senator Vandenberg told Harry Truman, you got to go out there and scare the hell out of them, Harry, because they knew that the Soviet Union was no threat at all. And then, of course, the Gulf of Tonkin incident to get us into Vietnam. I don't know if there was a specific lie to get us into the war in Korea, other than it's any of our business is a lie enough to me. Truman just sent the troops in the middle of the night, said that the UN mandate was good enough, and didn't, you know, let Congress know after the fact. Anyway, Vietnam, of course, the Gulf of Tonkin. What, Panama? This guy's a drug dealer? Well, I guess that's true, but it's only half true. The other half of the truth was he wasn't paying his dues to the CIA. And then, of course, James Baker gave Saddam Hussein the green light to invade Kuwait back in 1990 and created the whole situation. Well, I guess this leads us to September 11th, which I still am open to the possibility that a deliberate blind eye was turned like Pearl Harbor, although I haven't really seen the proof of that. It's certainly possible. And of course they used the excuse of going to get Osama bin Laden, who remains free to this day, to overthrow the government of Afghanistan and attempt to replace it with Hamid Landau Kalrizian Karzai, the cape-wearing mayor of Kabul, and of course as an excuse to ally us into war with Iraq. They said Al-Qaeda was taken over in Somalia.
You all crazy.
Why are we crazy?
Because you don't know how to stay alive. That's the secret of life.
But we have a war to win.
But America will lose the war. Right?
America's the strongest nation on earth. The American fighting man is the best trained, the best equipped, the best fed.
Exactly. Italy, on the other hand, is one of the weakest nations on earth. And the Italian fighting man is hardly equipped at all. And it's why my country is doing so well while your country is doing so poorly.
That's just silly. Italy was occupied by the Germans and is now being occupied by us. You call that doing well?
Of course I do. The Germans are being driven out and we're still here. In a few years you'll be gone and we will still be here. You see, Italy is a very poor, weak country. That is what makes us so strong. Strong enough to survive this war and still be in existence long after your country has been destroyed.
What are you talking about? America is not going to be destroyed.
Never.
Well?
Rome was destroyed. Greece was destroyed. Persia was destroyed. Spain was destroyed. All great countries are destroyed. Why not yours? How much longer do you think your country will last? Forever?
Well, forever is a long time, I guess.
For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. Proud to welcome back to the show Stephen Clemens from the New America Foundation and the author of the influential blog The Washington Note. Welcome back to the show, Steve. How are you?
Great to be with you, Scott.
It's been too long since we've spoken.
Well, there's a lot going on, and you've got many better guests than I am.
Yeah, well, whatever. That's very nice and self-effacing of you. But no, I'm very glad to have you back on the show to discuss, in particular, Israeli politics.
Sure.
It's difficult subject matter. I was actually just speaking with Jason Ditz, who writes up the news summaries at antiwar.com, and
right.
He's made himself a real expert in all these different parties and all the different politicians and how the coalition is. The president gets first pick at the coalition no matter who wins the election and all these interesting things. And it's few and far between that I can find people who really know the ins and outs of these things, who all these people are and what they represent and what it means to us. I guess from what I know in broad strokes, it's they're saying it's pretty clear that Benjamin Netanyahu is going to be the winner. Is that right?
Well, he's in the lead right now. And, anything can happen. You've got Tzipi Livni, the person running from the Kadima party, closing in a bit on Netanyahu and the Likud party, but we just don't know how it'll turn out. But right now, it's looking as if Netanyahu is running strong, and it also looks like all of the primary leaders in the race, which are Ehud Barak of the Labor Party, Livni of Kadima, and Netanyahu of Likud, are all chasing a kind of warmongering platform, if you will, and it's running rather strong with Israeli citizens right now, regrettably.
Yeah, one thing that Jason told me was that Ehud Barak's party, Labor, has done a bit better, that they were doing really bad until the war, and now they've doubled their percentage from 7 to 14 or something like that in the polls.
Right. I mean, Barak is someone who is credited in the past with having gotten pretty close to a peace deal and arrangement with the Palestinians. I think it is unusual and interesting that Barak since then hasn't really been on the sort of peace or negotiations agenda. If there was one person, and this is not, you know, too politic to say, I suppose, who has been responsible for helping to gin up greater stress with the Palestinians, it's Barak. You know, these cabinet decisions are cabinet decisions. Olmert, Livni certainly participated in what we saw in Gaza. But before that, Ehud Barak had a lot to do as Minister of Defense with setting the temperature of relations with the Palestinians in general, particularly on the West Bank, where he increased the number of barriers to transportation and barriers to movement with Palestinians by about 20% higher since the Annapolis process began by Bush and Condi Rice. And so he ratcheted up that tension. And also, when you had this kind of tit-for-tat game going on who really broke the so-called ceasefire between Israel and Hamas, it was Ehud Barak's orders at various times to go in and engage in some killings of Hamas leaders when he had a chance to do so, even though there had been a you know, prevailing ceasefire arrangement at that time. So Barak has been trying to some degree, break the back of both Livni and Olmert and by trying to move his party close to being a pro-war party, which is very, very odd to see in Israeli politics.
Well, he's just copying the American Democrats, right? Try to outflank the Republicans on the Iran issue, for example, if you're Hillary Clinton, or on the Pakistan-Afghanistan issue if you're Barack Obama, and then that way they can't call you a weakling, even though you're a liberal panty-waist and on other issues.
Yeah,
so
regrettably, I agree completely with that take.
Yeah, it is regrettable. and to see if the Labor Party, because as you said, I mean, I remember Barack was the guy that was preferable back in the 1990s, and it certainly is a bummer to see the if the Labor Party were the only ones who really had any intention of actually finally giving the West Bank and the Gaza Strip up to the Palestinians, it would be them. And if they want to outflank everybody on the right in order to be tough guys and get power, then there's really nobody that's trying to actually have peace here.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I should say to balance this out a bit is one of my real mentors on Israeli politics is a guy who's been a lead negotiator for the Israeli government before on some of these deals, and that is Daniel Levy. He works with me at the New America Foundation and leads with another fellow named Amjad Atala, our Middle East task force.
And I've talked with Daniel a few times, too, on the show.
Yeah, he's over in Israel now. He votes in every election. And he's taken me to meet people from the Likud party, the Kadima party, the Shas party, Labor, Maretz. I've met people from across the political spectrum there. And I should say that even though we're making, and probably further in this discussion, we'll be making sort of broad stroke generalizations about what Netanyahu might do or what Livni or what Barak might do. There are people within these parties, even Likud, believe it or not, who think that the current trajectory that Israel is on is crazy, that will produce a state that can't continue to be democratic or continue its Jewish character if they don't do something with the Palestinian situation in the Palestinian state. So I find that interesting that even there's a fellow who's one of the principal, very, very well-known advisors to the rabbi who is the head of the Shas party, very conservative party. But nonetheless, this guy's very progressive and was able to get his support for some rather pro-peace posture, if you will. Now, they're going to have trouble discussing things on, you know, Jerusalem and the Temple Mount. But to some degree, you've got greater flexibility within the Israeli political order than we're typically seeing from these, you know, gladiators at the top who right now are trying to, you know, ratchet themselves up in citizen approval by being the one to say the most vilifying things about Hamas.
It's really funny. You know, I've never been over there, and so I don't know, but it seems like the population over there must be a bunch of American rednecks, and their government is run by a bunch of George Bushes and Stephen Hadleys and incompetents like that.
Well,
I mean,
it's really not like that. I mean,
it seems as short. Yeah. The policies seem as short-sighted. Like you're saying, this trajectory that they're on to not really being able to maintain, one or two or more of the major characteristics that make Israel Israel over the long term. I mean, this is really, you might as well have had George Bush running the government over there.
Well,
it's been a disaster.
Israel is a complex place. I find it fascinating. I've been there now a number of times. It's a collage of cultures that have come together. Religion is a major part of the national identity of the state, but there are a lot of secular Jews over there who see the world differently, and there's a collage of these folks, and there are some things that might surprise you that I find very progressive about Israel's system. For instance, any Palestinian grievance, you know, whether it's related to the wall or some taking of property, et cetera, can be adjudicated through the Supreme Court in Israel, and often they vote in favor of the Palestinian claimant. So there are things like that you know, balance out some of the more horrible things that we've seen when any government and army occupies another state and people. And I should also say that I've seen the very, very bad side. I haven't seen the worst. I went through to Ramallah through the VIP checkpoint, in fact, where Mahmoud Abbas goes through and various UN agency folks go in and out of. And I was nonetheless having even a memo signed by the Ministry of Defense approving my transport into Ramallah. The Israeli Defense Force guards there held us up for 45, 50 minutes, pretty much harassed us a little bit. But and this is at the VIP porter, so you know, one you know, can't imagine what goes on in other places. And I eventually went in, and the two other folks I was with, who were significant, you know, Israelis, we just all said, "Shoot us if you want. We're walking into Ramallah," and we went in. And you know, there's that kind of constant tension that I think, to some degree, is promulgated and created by the IDF, and it's a sad thing. And it's just time that there's a broader spotlight. And when I say that Israel is very complex, Scott, the other thing is that it's very intriguing. If you read the Israeli press, Maariv and Haaretz and the Jerusalem Post, there's a much wider debate, even in the right-wing paper, the Jerusalem Post, than there is usually in the U.S. press. And that's something that I've been committed to try to widen at least our own debate in the United States to have the same character and content that the Israelis are able to do, which is quite impressive. So I wouldn't agree with your characterization of Israel that it's full of rednecks. It's full of sophisticated people. But, you know, as in any case, there's a lot of politics, and sometimes there's a hijacking of a political system by minority groups, particularly that want to intimidate, you know, the harder course of a more peaceful, or at least a more negotiated course with the Palestinians, who will one day be across the border.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I was basically trying to make the equivalency. I wasn't saying that they are rednecks, but it seems like, you know, hey, Gaza is attacking us. Let's defend ourselves from the terrorist enemy and bomb them all. And having everybody rally around that is what I would expect of Americans. I guess
the knee-jerk emotionalism was hard to watch this time, and the bravado that came from Tzipi Livni and others saying that any rockets would be met with disproportionate force. If you tried to speculate what Hamas was trying to achieve, then the Israeli government was giving Hamas exactly what it wanted, which was outrageous, flamboyant behavior and the effort of the overlord of the occupier to crush many innocents and others, because this can create a transformative dynamic that radicalizes even more Arabs in the region and helps fuel Hamas's legitimacy in their eyes. And so it's sort of perverse, but, you know, if I were running the Israeli state and you had a sounder crowd there, you try not to give Hamas what it wanted. Try not to radicalize more Arabs in the region. Try to give them the opposite of what they wanted. And there is a problem with the terror that's created by these rockets, but they rarely kill anyone. And it's not the question that they should just turn a blind eye. They need to be dealt with. But the kind of massive deployment of killing force that Israel did has probably undermined Israel's objectives and long-term security in the region, and it has probably built up Hamas and its legitimacy to a level that means that down the road, you know, we're going to have to find a way to deal with Hamas. And that's just the product of this encounter. So, you know, I think that when you've got, whether you call them terrorists, you call them insurgent organizations, you call them anti-colonizers, whatever, when you are a state, you should be able to try to explain to your people what kinds of moves you would make that do not automatically give your rival, the non-state actor who's trying to provoke you, the actions they want. And Israel gave Hamas exactly what it wanted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's, of course, the most important thing to understand about terrorism is that the action is in the reaction. Patrick Coburn on the show the other day explained, why would Sunni jihadists in Iraq a few years back in the Civil War, why would they attack a Shiite marketplace? It's to get the Shiite death squads to come and in reaction kill a bunch of Sunni civilians. Then the terrorists can say, see, you need us to protect you. You need, you know, we're the only ones who can protect you from the Shiite death squad that we just provoked into coming and killing people around you and whatever. And so that's how it works. Same thing with September 11th. To smack us in the face and dare us to come and dig in and fight wars in the Middle East, bleed us to bankruptcy is the stated objective, right?
I think there's something to that, and I think it's very important to realize that, you know, actors like, you know, groups that are trying to knock off a what they would see as sort of an occupation or a 21st century colonizer, as many Iraqis saw American activities in Iraq, that they're trying to operate in an asymmetric way with all the resources they can and trying to provoke actions and use our power almost in a jujitsu way against ourselves. And I think that one of the things that I find fascinating right now is that despite this having, you know, now passed, essentially an 8-year mark nearly, you've got a period of introspection where we're beginning to realize to some degree in this country, I think, that you just can't continue to give the rivals who are trying to provoke us the actions they want, because it ends up in these slippery slopes to real disasters for the United States, real over commitments of the military and a failure to achieve objectives and to get back to some sort of stable order. So that is why, you know, I've wrote in a piece on my blog recently about Netanyahu. I wrote it, so, you know, please give us Netanyahu, because to some degree it removes the veneer. It gives us exactly what we think, the right-wing side of Israel, the rejectionist side of Palestine, are completely unable to come to terms on their own with a long-term equilibrium or not to say even a peace that would allow a two-state solution to be created between Israel and Palestine. I still believe that solution does exist and is possible. But you cannot anymore play the game of thinking that the Israelis and the Palestinians can be act strategically mature enough to try and achieve an outcome that is good for either of them or good for the region or good for the world. And it is about time that the United States, Europe, the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the UN, Russia, realize that working with Netanyahu is probably a good thing to impose on him and his government, as well as the Palestinians, what kind of solution we stakeholders around it can accept and can't accept, and create costs and incentives for not moving forward. Because we've just reached a level where the continued failure to solve this problem is undermining American security, and that's just an unacceptable status quo that has to be changed.
Mm. Well, except, and what if we get Netanyahu and it doesn't create that kind of external pressure, and we just end up having a Likud government and more wars in Gaza and in the West Bank?
It's hard for me to imagine that. I mean, if Netanyahu does any of the things that he's promised in his campaign, and we've all seen, you know, Barack Obama go through a metamorphosis after he won, he's certainly not the same guy as president as he was when running for office. We all go through changes, and Netanyahu has been intimating to people that he's matured since the last time he was prime minister and would do things differently. But we do know that he's dead set against dealing with Hamas and would probably deliver more force there, and that we know that you know, he is pro-settler and you know, favors the further expansion of existing settlements, and I think turns a blind eye to the expansion of non-official settlements. Mm-hmm. Those settlements are incredibly toxic to the entire process, and so they basically deliver at least what I think will be ongoing radicalization of this problem. And I think that we should not be blind to the fact that that's probably where this was going. And as I said in this piece I wrote, I'm about finished with the earnest approach. Let's get the balanced person. Let's make Mahmoud Abbas a winner. This is what the White House National Security Council is considering doing right now, and I'm calling it too much, too late. They're going to try and shower Abbas, the president of the Palestinian Authority, with all sorts of goodies that he can now shower onto other Palestinians to try and show in their mind that he can deliver, whereas Hamas can't. And I just find that to be effective late. And even Mahmoud Abbas's mandate expired in January. So to a certain degree, we've got back into legitimacy problems with Palestinian leadership, and we're going to try to, you know, tilt the optics on the Palestinian side towards Fatah. And as we do that, I think we're going to delegitimate them even further. But
right,
it's
and then
better
who else
to
is
see
there?
All of that, and better to get out of the weeds on these issues, and better to say, what can we do? The consequences of failing here are so enormous. What can we really do in a more forceful way to push you know, a government that has someone like Netanyahu at its helm towards a more constructive stance? And I think we can do that. I think the crazier he is, I think the better it is for actual, you know, actually getting out of the weeds on this stuff and imposing a solution that might work.
Well, as far as dealing with Hamas, I mean, there's nobody else to deal with in Gaza except Hamas. You're not going to be able to put Fatah back in there. They already tried that, right?
Well, I mean, I think that what will eventually happen is you'll have a synthesized unity government again, as we once did. And we're the ones who broke that government apart. It made the Saudis furious because they had worked hard to get Fatah and Hamas together and worked hard to get Hamas to agree to accept the instruments of state that had been previously negotiated and to come to terms with that order. And so they weren't going to be on the front end of dealing with Israel, although, by the way, there are many Hamas mayors on the West Bank that already deal with the IDF, and for all the kind of baloney that Israel doesn't talk to Hamas, it's just simply not true. There's enormous levels of back channel communication between Hamas and Israeli government.
Well, and seeing this gets back to what you were saying, or actually something else that I'm going to say about what Hamas wants, because you were talking about what Hamas wants in the context of firing the rockets in the time after the ceasefire ended. But I saw an interview with Norman Finkelstein where he said that what Hamas wanted was to continue the ceasefire. Gareth Porter, of course, wrote an article about how Hamas tried to extend it in or get back to it in December and were rebuffed. And how that basically the what Finkelstein was saying was that the Israeli strategy was to not let Hamas be a responsible ceasefire-keeping government for any period of time. That
well,
they want
that
peace,
simple.
But only on their terms.
It's not that simple, because while there's been a ceasefire, Hamas, you know, cordoned off in Gaza, has at the same time been using the fact that Israel was choking off access, food supplies, humanitarian support, and other material to Gaza. They were letting in, you know, maybe 100, 150 trucks a day, when what's needed for that size population is upwards of 750 to 800 trucks a day, that the only way for this population to survive are these so-called smuggling tunnels. So food and materials have been smuggled in, a lot with guns and ammunition and rockets and material from Iran and other sources that, you know, with the, and so you had Hamas able to deliver to its people the goods and services through these tunnels, but then also to basically arm itself for ongoing harassment of Israel. Hamas is not a superpower. Israel is the only regional superpower with incredible military capacity in that region. So it is using the ceasefires, and Israel's right on this, to help, you know, to load up its munitions and to help give it the wherewithal to continue to harass Israelis mission. But it's something that, you know, after Fatah and Hamas had split, the United States helped create this civil war. You know, Israel just sat with Gaza, you know, cordoned off and in a stranglehold and did nothing and just let this thing fester. So you can't let, you know, 1.5 million people just sit there and fester in a strip of you know, really what is truly hell on earth, and not provide them supplies, humanitarian support, economic wherewithal, and not expect that the one, you know, powerful authority down there, which is Hamas, isn't going to both look good in the eyes of Palestinian citizens, and two, isn't going to do things to continue to harass as Hamas wants to continue to grow in the eyes and eventually knock out its political rivals Fatah in having the stewardship of Palestine and its interests down the road. So I think that what is missing on the Israeli side is any sense of strategy that, you know, to some degree, Hamas, they created the situation in Gaza, and they allowed it to fester. They knew what was going on. And so the ceasefires, the way they exist in the ecosystem which Israel has put together, is yes, Hamas arms itself and then continues to harass Israel. So you've got something that right now is set up to be a chronic ulcer which will never ever go away, and the consequences of which are now beginning to involve American security and frankly American credibility more and more in ways that have very far-reaching consequences potentially for the United States throughout the Arab world.
Mm. Well, you know, the book Perfect Soldiers by Terry McDermott, the Los Angeles Times reporter,
right?
He makes pretty clear in there what Mohammed Atta's motive was, and it was Israel in Lebanon and in Palestine. It wasn't American bases in Saudi Arabia. That was Osama bin Laden's problem. Mohammed Atta's problem was Israel.
Well, I mean, you may have different grievances driving different people. I think that you have in the Arab peace deal, which King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia offered first in 2002 and which still is on the table, you had a normalization offer of 22 Arab states normalizing relations with Israel. And that offer has festered too long without enough attention, and it's got to somehow be made a reality, because for Israel to walk away from a deal that would solve essentially its relations with most of its neighbors, I think is the best way to confront Iran without bombing and confronting Iran's pretensions in the region than anything else. And if Israel can't move in that direction, then it's achieved a level of fundamental strategic irresponsibility that the United States needs to take matters into its own hands as far as that relationship and about the character and conduct of Israel's strategy. You know, it's very interesting.
Stop right there. Yeah. I want to hear interesting in Bill Clinton in a second, but yeah. What you're saying is Israel has got to get their act together as far as a permanent solution in Palestine and peace with the Arab states, because otherwise they won't be able to have any leverage for a united front with the Arab states against Iran, which has benefited so greatly, of course, from our war in Iraq.
That's right. The best thing that Israel can do to move regional stability, its own security, and American interests forward is normalizing relations with these 22 Arab states. It then robs Iran of the legitimacy that Iran has been trying to do with regard to Israel. And I think that it helps get us back into some sort of equilibrium in the region.
Well, what about normalizing relations with Iran?
Israel's been completely negligent in this, and I think Netanyahu's been among the worst. But oftentimes, you know, and I'll be on, you know, National Public Radio later on today, I'll say sometimes it takes the worst to pull off the most credible deals. And I don't want to be naive, and I don't want to even, you know, project that Netanyahu might be the guy to be able to do this. But, you know, it is a Nixon goes to China model that sometimes is most compelling. Yeah. When you take, you know, America's top, most ferocious, anti-communist cold warrior, and you turn him into the guy who goes to China. Now, that would be nice with Netanyahu. I find myself unable to believe it will be there. But what I do know is that his recklessness, his reckless rhetoric, his reckless behavior, and his support of settler associations and whatnot that have done so much damage to the Palestinian-Israeli possibilities, essentially, is that can finally show the country, while we're paying attention to these issues, it's no longer a boutique issue controlled by, you know, a small minority of interest in the United States. There's a huge amount of attention on the Middle East right now. That kind of behavior won't be tolerated. There's a huge spotlight, and Americans and strategists are paying attention. So I think for the first time in a long time, we'll see U.S.-Israel relations move out from being a domestic policy problem in the U.S. to what is really finally a geostrategic challenge.
Mm. Well, and as you've documented so well, your friends, I guess, or your colleagues, associates, formerly with the National Security Council, Leverett.
Flint Leverett.
Flint Leverett and Hillary
sure.
Mann. They were on the receiving end of what seemed to be a pretty reasonable peace offer by the Iranians themselves back in 2003. And I wonder whether you think that there's a reasonable chance that peace could be made with all these different factions, and why not, if not?
Well, you know, I'm not naive about how difficult it is to achieve peace. In fact, I joke with people that I don't believe in peace. I just believe in equilibria. You know, stable equilibria could become peace over time. But when Flint and Hillary Mann Leverett were involved with this, you know, Iranian normalization offer in the spring of 2003, the Iranians saw the United States on a roll. They saw us and perceived us to be standing high in our saddle and as globally strong and as ascending. And this is right after the Iraq invasion. Our position vis-a-vis Iran and the rest of the world right now has slipped dramatically. And while Iran also has some problems, oil prices have fallen, and, you know, they have their elections coming up in June and certainly have domestic difficulties there. We don't know, as we used to talk about in the Cold War, whether the correlation of forces as perceived by the Iranians have changed anything to change their calculus as to why they might be willing to work with us again. I happen to think, and I know Flint Leverett agrees, that there's nothing harmed by putting forward a credible proposal and by trying to marshal forward the convergence of interest with Russia, with China, with Europe, and move us to sort of a more sophisticated strategy that is less geared towards beating Iran up and more geared towards helping Iran to see that it would have credible benefits, be treated with respect, be able to allow its security paranoias to subside, to get the United States out of the regime change business. These kinds of things may change the calculus for the Supreme Leader Khamenei and even President Ahmadinejad if we were to move in that direction. But there are no guarantees. But I have to tell you, we should do something along those lines. And if Iran and the Supreme Leader, as he's often known to be, indecisive as he is, decides not to go that way, then at least the rest of the world sees it. And America reacquires some of the mystique that it used to have as a global balancer and as a more benign force. So that's what I hope my friends on the National Security Council staff are thinking and hearing about today. I still think we've got a lot of work to do on the Obama team, but I know they read you, Scott, and listen to your show.
Oh, really? On the National Security Council staff?
Well, anti-war has transcripts and great tapes, and they'll listen.
All right. If you say so. Well, I'd like them to listen to this. You know, overhear this part of the conversation especially. Steve, I'm so puzzled. The entire intelligence establishment of George Bush's administration under Thomas Fingar,
right,
the head of the National Intelligence Council, in November of 2007, after Dick Cheney, we know because Phil Giraldi and them had reported it suppressed it for a year, and it finally came out, and it said Iran is not making nuclear weapons. And Joe Biden's on TV talking about Iran's illicit weapons program, quote unquote, and Robert Gates, of course, the still Secretary of Defense, says they're hell-bent on acquiring a nuclear weapon, and I'm quite shocked. It's actually even further than the way that the Bush team mischaracterized the Iraq NIE of 2002.
I think you're onto something, and I think that, you know, when I had Tom Fingar speak at the New America Foundation, I asked him then if he thought that any of the core criteria of that 2007 Iran NIE had been changed, and he intimated that there had not, but that it might be appropriate for someone in Congress or one of the customers of the National Intelligence Council to ask for an update, essentially what is an update, so that they can go back through a sophisticated process and bring forward anything that would continue. That would help change the assessment of the intelligence community. I think that what's happening is that in Joe Biden's comments and Gates' comments and others, they're using a slippery slope form of language of talking about Iran's nuclear energy activity, its reprocessing activity with these centrifuges, and presuming that this is all giving Iran dual use capabilities with regard to eventual production of a potential nuclear weapon. So we need to have, you know, some sophisticated folks who understand these things go back, because I agree with you that, you know, we're being misled
That's quite a slippery slope, the difference between, well, there's an IAEA inspector in a white lab coat with a clipboard and an electronic doo-wacky in his hand measuring radiation outputs and making sure that everything is okay like they've said it is this entire time with no exceptions, as far as, you know, the centrifuge is spinning at Natanz and everything else. It's quote-unquote capital S safeguarded. That's a legal term, you know.
Right.
It is a safeguarded facility. It's not a nuclear weapons program. It can't be both.
Well, I think that you know, the Iran program, to put some blame on the Iran side, continues to frustrate the IAEA a bit. In its reporting and the confessions of past deeds and, you know, some issues. But you know, Mohammed al-Baradei sees progress. He is optimistic. I like al-Baradei and the approach that he's taken. He's proved to be far more right than he has proved to be wrong over these issues. And I wish the U.S. would get out of the fear-mongering game, which I find to be disconcerting when you're trying to show a different face to the world and try to see what is possible. But at least thus far, they're maintaining the tough rhetoric because they think they need to do that in fear of being called appeasers.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I talked with, if I can get one more line of questioning out of you here.
Sure.
I talked with Patrick Coburn, as I mentioned, and he is of the view that America has lost the Iraq war. There are not going to be 58 bases. There are not going to be 14 bases. There are not going to be any bases. And the Iraqis are kicking us out, and it's going to be 16 months, whether the Americans believe it or not, whether they like it or not. The war is over, and the Dawa Party and the people of Iraq won, and that's it. Do you think that that's, do you agree with that? And do you think that if you agree that that's basically the reality of the situation, do you think that, well, for example, your friends on the National Security Council staff understand that as well?
We're not going to know for a while. I don't want to participate too much in these characterizations of who won and who lost. In my view, who won was Iran. You know, we fought the Iraq War and Iran won because we removed their chief regional rival and threat and didn't anticipate that, and it opened up a whole new set of issues in the region, which we're now struggling with, and that we were very poorly prepared for. Inside Iraq, it's going to be interesting to see whether the stability, you know, the structures we put in place and the deals between, you know, the Kurds, the Sunnis, and the Shia will hold, or whether the moment that we're gone, whether they'll be crumbled down, and whether you actually do have some sort of devolution downwards to some, you know, regional scramble for resources and the assets of the state between these contending groups, and whether or not you, once the United States is gone, whether you, if you do get a return to violence, which is not too hard to imagine, whether you get Iraq becoming a, you know, a proxy battleground between Saudi and other Sunni Arab interests and Iran. So we just don't know. I think it's kind of like, you know, Vietnam. You know, you don't know what happens until you leave. And to a certain degree in Iraq, I don't think our departure is necessarily a loss. If the place remains rather stable, then that's what we're going to see in war, is not decisive victories or decisive losses. But what would be a decisive loss is if, you know, we depart the place and, you know, everything comes undone and the, you know, power relationships between other key stakeholders in the region just really go out of balance, and drawing in other regional players to fight it out in Iraq. That would be miserable and would add on to the complexities and real lousy situation in Afghanistan.
Well, so does that mean that if it looks like things are going to get you know, much more imbalanced in the region, so to speak, if we leave, that then we won't? The 16 months in the SOFA, which is the law. I mean, the UN mandate is gone. The only law that governs American presence in Iraq right now is the Status of Forces Agreement.
Look, Barack Obama has left himself an escape hatch. He's been pushing the 16-month departure. Military officials, I hear behind the scenes, are trying to dissuade him from that. And thus far, Obama's sticking to his guns. Military commanders are worried. We live in a world where we're given too much deference to military commanders, in my view. But if one's to be realistic about the equation is, you know, there's a perfectly understandable scenario out there where at the end these commanders, fearing the world and the narrative I just shared with you, convince Obama not to draw down quite as much. And I think that would be really regrettable, because I do think we need to. I think we have Iraq as a ball and chain around our neck, and I think it limits the perception that America can matter elsewhere in the world because of the bleeding, the way this is bleeding our military and financial capacity.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like the Washington Post put out a piece helping Odierno try to undercut his commander-in-chief just the other day. What, Saturday, right?
Exactly.
Or was it Sunday? I mean, and that goes along with Gareth Porter's reporting about, and in fact, it verified a lot of, or at least parts of it, about the role of this guy, Jack Keane. You're kind of plugged in Washington, D.C. They say in that Post piece that this retired general, Jack Keane, is more influential than most actual four-star generals active duty, that he kind of helped Odierno go around the Joint Chiefs of Staff and his commanders in Iraq and everything and go straight to the White House in order to get an increased number of troops there.
Yeah, it's very interesting for those people who don't know what we're talking about. There's a series of articles and videos as part of the release of Tom Ricks' new book. Tom Ricks is the military correspondent for the Washington Post that I recommend people take a look at. It is disconcerting because on one hand you look at these military guys as they're trying to depict them as heroes and as straight shooters and as smart strategists who were able to get around the anachronistic and stifling bureaucracy of the military to affect the president's decisions. So I can see that story. It makes a great movie. On the other hand, when it comes to dealing with complex challenges, it's a very scary scenario that you're going to have freelancers and folks essentially coming, you know, clearly around with authorities that don't, you know, really exist and turning a national security decision-making process into an ad hoc one. And maybe that's what we needed. I don't want to wrestle over that right now. It's not my issue. But I do think that there is a national security decision-making is something that ought not to be a function of some, you know, general gets a bright idea one day and says, okay, let's traipse off and do it this way. If I can only end run all my colleagues and rivals and get to Bush or Obama, that's a very scary kind of decision making formula.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it really does seem like the way it's supposed to be is pretty obvious, right? Which is, you know, General, I want out in 16 months. Well, sir, may I please state the 15 reasons why I disagree? Yes, you may. Here they are. Okay, I still want out in 16 months. Now his choice is either to salute smartly and say yes, sir, or resign. Not to say, oh yeah, well I'm going to talk to my buddies at the Post and we're going to see if we can fix your wagon, Mr. President, when he's how many ranks down the chain from this guy? I mean, what? This is crazy.
Yeah, well, a lot of them want to have agents and movies and blockbuster bestsellers down the road. So.
Yeah, well, I guess we could look forward to that at least. All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate talking to you, and I apologize for my hyperbole, but I hope it helped to get the best out of you. I think it
Anytime,
did.
Anytime, Scott. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
I'm a charger that charges through the night like an orange bolt of lightning, passing everything in sight. I'm the best pal the Duke boy has ever had. I'm thunder on the highway looking bad, bad, bad. I'm a knight like the kind in shining armor with my polished body gleaming.
All right, y'all, this is Anti-War Radio, and here's the deal. I'm back on Chaos Radio. Thanks to everybody who said, hey, what the hell, you should do Chaos Radio. For people who turned in late, missed the beginning, I guess I'll tell you, I think I left this part out. I'm going to be Tuesdays through Fridays here from 11 to 1 Pacific time. So do the math yourself. Broadcasting out of Los Angeles. And I'm making progress. I have announcements. I just can't announce them to you. But the radio thing is going well. So just hold your horses. We'll get to that. And one of the benefits of Chaos is that it's a station that mostly plays a bunch of kick-ass punk rock and metal at night, which means that there's nobody's show that comes on after me today on Tuesday, at least, which means I'm staying overtime because you guys probably, you know, assuming you're deliberately listening to my show right now on Chaos Radio, would like to, I don't know, hear James Bamford explain the Orwellian police state that surveils your every move. Seems like an interesting topic to me. This is Anti-War Radio, back on Chaos in Austin.
The pride of the South they call the General Lee. I'm the General Lee, a pistol puppet, steel belted cavalry. I'll never let you down when you're riding with me. Buckle up and I'll show you what I mean. Take a look back there, sirens blowing, red lights flashing everywhere. I'll jump that pond and we'll be running free. And they'll go swimming compliments of me. The General Lee. The General Lee. General Lee.
For Antiwar.com, I'm Scott Horton. This is Antiwar Radio. Introducing James Bamford. He's the, I think, probably now legendary author of books about the National Security Agency, The Puzzle Palace, Body of Secrets, and the newest one, The Shadow Factory. Also in there was the A Pretext for War, not about the NSA, but another great book. And this one, The Shadow Factor, is really something else. I urge everyone to go out and get it or order it off the internet, get it delivered right to your mailbox. It's a shame to think you'd have all this information in a book and people hadn't read it, because this is just page after page of groundbreaking work. So you definitely deserve a lot of credit for it. And it was great to actually see the video of a lot of your work that we talked about the last time that we spoke, Jim, on Nova the other night, the Nova special about the National Security Agency, where they showed your work where you actually went to the Al-Qaeda safe house in Yemen, went to Malaysia where the meeting was held, the conspiracy for the September 11th attacks and all this kind of stuff. And it's really interesting to see how much work you really put into writing each one of these books, traveling the whole world, really, huh?
Well, thanks, Scott. Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, it was fascinating doing the research and actually going to the places that, you know, where all this took place, especially in Yemen, where the we found Bin Laden's operations center, his former operations center, where that's where the original message was sent out from and was received. That NSA intercepted the message sending the first two hijackers on the first part of their mission, Qaid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hazmi. They were sent from there to Kuala Lumpur. So, and that was the message that NSA intercepted and sort of the beginning of 9/11. So it was very fascinating finding the house. It took a while once we were in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, to actually find where that house was. And it got a little hairy at a couple of times when we were trying to look for it, because it's in a really pretty bad section of town and people don't like cameras shooting locations like that.
Yeah, well, I can imagine so. And really, there's a lot of stuff in the book that didn't make the Nova thing. So if people saw the special, that's just a taste. And in fact, it's apparent from the writing that you went a lot more places than are, featured in the TV special as well. And in fact, they focused a lot on the September 11th attacks and what the NSA knew and could have done about them, as we did the last time we spoke. And that archive is available at antiwar.com/radio. It's from last October 22nd. And we focus mostly on the 9/11 part of the story in that. But I wanted to give you a chance to I think, kind of fill in what was left out and over the other night, which was the extent of the law breaking and the violating of Americans' rights that began taking place during the Bush administration. I don't necessarily want to say it's ended now because I don't really know exactly where we stand now, but Nova seemed to kind of want to, ignore just how terribly in violation of the law the Bush administration was, and to what extent they actually began to turn the entire national security intelligence apparatus and all of that electronic eavesdropping capability against the American people.
Well, the purpose of NOVA was, there's two programs similar that focus on major issues on PBS. One is Frontline, the other is NOVA. Frontline focuses on the political aspect. The beauty of NOVA was we were focusing on the technology, how it's done. You only have less than an hour.
Right.
Not much time. So it gave us a unique opportunity to be able to show the public exactly how it worked and how the communications was intercepted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we spent the whole hour talking about why it shouldn't have been done, then we wouldn't have had any time to do the story about how it's done. And there's been a lot of commentary. I read a whole book about why it shouldn't have been done. So the beauty of NOVA is to show how it's accomplished, how NSA manages to pull in all this information, what it does with it, where it pulled in from. We actually shot the base. I got onto the base down in Georgia, near Augusta, Georgia, where NSA does all its eavesdropping on the Middle East. And so we had, were able to put up on television visuals, video of all these places that I actually wrote about. So it was really fascinating actually seeing how the system worked. We traced an email message all the way from Kuala Lumpur to the building in San Francisco where NSA has its secret room, traced it to the beach where the cable first comes ashore, to this little facility where AT&T receives all these cables in San Luis Obispo, and then up to San Francisco. One of the key points we made on the program was the fact that if all NSA wanted to do was to tap into the international communications in and out of the United States, the perfect place to do that is in this little building that we showed in San Luis Obispo, because that's where all the cables enter and terminate. Mm-hmm. So if you put your secret room there, you're getting just the information that's coming from Asia and just the information that's going to Asia. But instead, they put the secret room AT&T's major switching facility, this very large building, 10-story building, in downtown San Francisco. And what makes that very suspicious is that's not only where you get a lot of the international communications coming in, but it's also where a lot of the domestic communications gets intermingled with it. So NSA is picking up not just the information coming and going from foreign countries, but it's picking up internal U.S. communications by building its secret room in that building.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you say so, in the book, don't you, that there's... You say in the book, don't you, that there are switching or splitter rooms like this at basically all the AT&T headquarters, 30 of them or something around the country too, right? Not just at that one.
Among the people we interviewed was Mark Klein, who was a longtime technician. He worked for AT&T for his whole career, and he was in charge of one of the floors in that building, and he had been doing this a long time. I mean, he knew what cables went where and how things were done. He graduated from Cornell and spent most of his career as a communications engineer. And then one day he discovered this secret room, and he didn't have a key to it. Nobody he knew had a key to it, and the only way to get access was through a secret combination. And the only person that had that was an employee that had previously been associated with the NSA or had been cleared by the NSA. So he was the one that first tipped the world off to the fact that NSA had this secret room, and he managed to get a number of documents out of the AT&T facility showing exactly how the engineering was done in the room. And among the things he told us was that in talking to other people, he found out there were similar rooms to that in probably at least between half a dozen and a dozen other AT&T facilities.
And this amounts to basically, if I understand your book correctly, this amounts to all the web traffic, everything that Americans do online is intercepted by the government, whether it's making phone calls or instant messages or our contact lists on our webmail account or any of these things. All of it, all of our search terms in the search engines, right?
Yeah, what it does is the cables come into this one of the floors in this building, and these are fiber optic cables, the way communications are transmitted these days through glass fibers, and the actual communications are done with photons, the light signal. So the cables come into the room, and then they go into this device known as a splitter box, which is basically a series of prisms. And each cable is split at that point, and one side of the cable goes the way it's supposed to go to Kansas or to New York or to Florida, wherever the communication is supposed to go. It goes on its way unhindered. And an identical copy of everything, an identical version of that cable, sort of a clone version of that cable, then goes down to NSA's secret room one floor below. So you have all these cables come in. They go through these splitter boxes. Duplicates are made of everything, and while one copy goes on its normal course of travel, the other copies go down to the NSA secret room and are subjected to NSA analysis. One of those cables contains email or instant message or any kind of data that has a name like James Bamford or an email address that they're interested in, or a word or a phrase or anything that they programmed into the computer. And, you know, you have to realize that there's more than 500,000 names now on the watch list. So that information's put into the computers, and anytime there's a hit on a name, an address, a word, a phrase, that information then gets forwarded on to NSA. So, in essence, this would be the equivalent maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, of the U.S. Post Office opening every piece of mail coming into the post office to see who it's from, who it's going to, whether there's any keywords in there. And I don't think, you know, people back then would have put up with the U.S. government opening and reading their mail. That's why I'd like to, you know, I hope that there's more of a reaction to the Bush administration's implementation of this warrantless eavesdropping than there has been, because right now it appears that, you know, they've gotten away with it. Nobody was charged. Nobody was indicted. Even though that's a violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they clearly admitted it. George Bush, the day after the New York Times finally broke the story, Ryerson and Lichtblau, when they broke the story, he came out and he said, yeah, that's right, I did it, and I'm going to keep on doing it. And then I guess later on he decided that they would abide by the FISA statute, but then the Congress went and amended the FISA statute, if I understand right, to basically legalize what he'd done and allow them to continue this on. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. The Congress changed the law, and I mean, this is what Bush could have done in the first place if he really wanted to do this, was go to Congress, have them change the law so that it reflected the changes he wanted to make. The problem was he didn't do that. He didn't follow the legal route, at least not for the first 4 years or so. So during that whole period of time, when before the Congress enacted the Protect America Act and later the amendments to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the time between 9/11 when the warrantless eavesdropping program began and the time when Congress started taking action to rewrite the eavesdropping laws, all that was illegal eavesdropping. There was no authorization for that. It was a violation of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it was that's a criminal statute. It's a felony. It carries 5 years in prison for every violation, every time somebody is illegally surveilled.
Well, so under the current law, I mean, the Fourth Amendment, notwithstanding, because apparently it's not standing, under the current law, the amendments bill that they passed coming up on a year ago, does that basically still allow the kind of carte blanche that was going on under Bush's edict?
Well, no, because they have written into the law a role for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. When Bush was involved with his warrantless eavesdropping, they had basically completely bypassed the court. It would be shown to the chief justice or the presiding judge in the court, but it wouldn't go to the court per se. Even though the chief judge could look at it, the chief judge didn't have any right to object to it. So they completely cut out the role of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which was the only buffer between NSA and the public. So when Congress created these new amendments or changed the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, basically, it rewrote the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court into it. But now the court has been watered down a great deal in the new bill. It basically has the authority to look at the procedures that are used, the general procedures, and okay the general procedures, but it's still not given authority to review every name that is submitted for eavesdropping.
But so does that mean that the computers are all still vacuuming up every email I send, whether they're authorized to look at it or not?
Yeah, I think it's probably expanded since then because now they feel they have the imprimatur of a congressionally passed law. I would assume it's a expanding, and that was one of the other areas we got into in the NOVA program was not just the question of legality, but the question of efficiency. The agency has a hard time handling normal amounts of information, let alone the flood of information that comes in from all these intercept facilities. It has very few linguists. I interviewed two of the NSA intercept operators, and they were both stationed at the NSA's principal Middle East listening post at Fort Gordon, Georgia. And they were saying that there was nobody there, nobody, zero number of people there that spoke Pashtun, which is the key language in one of the key languages in Afghanistan at the time we went to war with Afghanistan. It'd be sort of like going to war, World War II against the Japanese and having nobody that spoke Japanese, or going to war with Russia and having nobody that spoke Russian. So, NSA is pulling all this stuff in. The question is, how useful is it? They're being swamped. How many people say key words in their emails or key combination of emails? And how many people does NSA have to read all this stuff? And if they're reading Americans' communications, why aren't they reading instead you know, communications between Pakistan and Afghanistan or whatever. You only have a finite number of people who have finite number of capabilities. And as one of the intercept operators told me, she felt she was wasting her time listening to Americans when, you know, she had joined basically to fight terrorism and eavesdrop on the enemy.
Well, and that's why it all comes down to the software, right? Because if they have her eavesdropping on some soldier talking to his wife back home from Iraq or something like that, you know, this flood of emails that may make reference to all kinds of things in all kinds of different contexts, it all comes down to how smart you can make the computer at deciphering what's of value and what's not. And I guess the way you reported in the book is that basically the Israelis won the contract for deciphering the global information or total information awareness here and deciding what's valuable information and what's not. Because, like, well, for example, when I email you, it's cool because of the TV show, I get to imagine, I got the great visual thing from Nova, and I get to imagine, like, I email James Bamford from my BlackBerry, and it bounces from here to there, and the NSA gets it off the prism this way, and the call gets routed like it was supposed to the other way, and you answer back, and we arrange interview time, and, I mean, certainly, well, I don't know. I would think it's a pretty safe bet that they're monitoring you, but how do they decide whether your communication with me is worth paying any attention to, or whether they only want to pay attention when you're talking to their former employees, that kind of thing? It's got to be automatic, right? The computer's got to be able to figure that out.
Yeah, it's two, you know, it's handled different ways, email communications and telephone communications. With email, they could, you know, simply put my email address in and everything going to me or coming from me will be picked up by it. Or they could program it so that it only picks up the communications when your email address contacts my email address. They could do whatever they want. I mean, they could program it however they want. Doing the emails can be done largely by machine analysis. They could have machines that pick these out. But on the telephone calls, which is what these intercept operators were working on, they were actually sitting there with earphones on, listening to people call, and they're taking in everything. They were American journalists calling their editors, calling their spouses back in the U.S., American soldiers in the war zone, calling their wives or husbands back in the U.S. and thinking that these are very private conversations or having very intimate discussions, and not knowing that there's people in the state of Georgia that are listening to it and frequently laughing about the conversations and passing them around the spaces. So the other thing is that once those calls are recorded, according to the people I interviewed, nobody erases them. They're there forever. And one of the things that I uncovered for the my book, The Shadow Factory, was the fact that NSA is currently building a new storage facility in Texas. It's a data storage facility that is going to be almost the size of the Alamo Dome for storing data, and you can see why now that they need such a enormous facility to store data. If they take in all this communications information, a lot of it between Americans, and never bother to erase any of it.
Well, they I'm confused because, or not really confused, but or maybe I am. But you're not saying that they only have humans to listen to the phone calls, right? Because don't they have the software that can decipher, I think you say in the book, it can decipher the same voice on any phone number and even figure out how mad you are and that kind of thing.
No, that's if you're targeting a particular person or whatever. But from everybody I've talked to, right now, NSA is not advanced further than having a human being listen to a human being.
Oh, that's reassuring then, because I guess I figured that it was just as automated, that the people who were doing the listening, for the most part, that maybe I guess I thought those people down in Georgia were the exception or something, that mostly the people doing the listening were getting phone calls that had already been referred to them by the computer who that had flagged it for some reason.
The computer picks up these communications, and you can program the computer to pick up whatever you want in terms of telephone numbers, but the computer doesn't do an analysis of voice content of the phone call. It just isolates phone calls based on telephone numbers. And what the intercept operators were saying was that they would get Americans calling, innocent Americans calling innocent Americans, and they could easily just push a button, and the next time the satellite and the computers picked up that phone number, or that phone number going to, you know, the home phone number, it would just be rejected. It wouldn't be put in the, what they call the queue. It wouldn't be put in the bank of calls that the NSA people are listening to. But they were told they weren't supposed to delete any of those numbers. And that means that they're actually targeted. So once it picks up, and you don't delete it, from then on, it'll continually pick up that phone call, which means that if you're leaving it in there, you're targeting that number from then on. So those American numbers were then being targeted. But the technology at NSA is not advanced to the point where it could have a machine listen to the human voice and transcribe it or analyze it. It's human beings sitting there listening. That's why they're expanding the NSA Georgia facility now.
I was going to say, how many people are we talking about?
4,000 people.
Because, I mean, what percentage of phone calls are these people actually able to listen to them? I mean, it's got to be a teeny tiny percentage, unless you just have fields and fields of spies like wheat, right?
Well, the ones they're listening to... one of the intercept operators I was talking to worked in a facility at Fort Gordon where they targeted the Inmarsat satellite. That was the satellite that is used by people in the Middle East, mostly Americans actually, to communicate. The system that's being used, the Inmarsat, was used at one time by Osama bin Laden also. So the idea was to pull everything off that satellite, all the communications, and it would be all pulled off, and they'd some would go to one person, some others would go to another person, some others would go to another person, but the whole idea is to pick everything off that satellite. Now, they don't always have to transcribe every single phone call. I mean, if it's a phone call that doesn't have any intelligence relevance, they wouldn't necessarily transcribe every word. But it does get recorded, and nobody erases the recording, so those phone calls. So if you had a phone call with your wife or with your editor or somebody else, 3 years ago, there's that phone call. There's a good chance that actual voice phone call is in storage, possibly down at the NSA's facility in Texas.
Well, you know, I
pretty
once...
scary if you do a, you know, somebody down there with a malicious intent decides to do a search and find all the communications that, somebody made. Somebody may be running for office. It could be used for political reasons. There's no reason at all to save all that stuff. And there should be laws saying that it should be erased. But as far as I know, there aren't. They haven't included that in any of the new bills.
Well, I one time recorded an interview with Glenn Greenwald about the legal aspects of just this kind of thing, and my computer crashed, and I lost the recording. And I wonder if I could go to Georgia somewhere and get my Lost Greenwald interview?
Well, you have to understand also that NSA, in terms of voice intercepts, telephone calls, they're focusing almost exclusively on international communications to and from the U.S.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was going to build in that he was out of the country at the time that we spoke as well. So.
Well, then that could, you know, then there's a good chance they could have it. If it's purely domestic.
Not that that would make it worth
domestic,
it.
Then that would be the FBI that would be involved.
Mm-hmm. Now, I just like to think that there's a backup archive of this show somewhere, you know, in case of worst case scenario. Tell me about
When I wrote the Puzzle Palace a long time ago, I did a lot of radio programs and TV programs and so forth after the book came out. And my publisher was Houghton Mifflin in Boston, and they had a clipping service, and they'd send me some clips if I, my name appeared in a newspaper or something like that. But it wasn't until I sent a Freedom of Information Act request to NSA for requesting my whole file that I got this massive transcript. So almost every show I was ever on, they had a transcript of it. And so
creepy.
It was, in one sense, it was sort of like having a free clipping service where they had a transcript of all my radio programs.
Well, now, did they have a FISA warrant for that, or under what jurisdiction were they tapping your phone? That's admitting a felony to you right there, isn't it?
They weren't tapping my phone.
They were just listening to the show. Yeah, that's all.
That's public domain.
I got you. I'm an idiot. I got you. All right, well, so tell me about the... that's interesting, though, to know how close attention they pay to your work. Tell me about the role of Israeli companies in writing the software for a lot of this spying and I don't know, possible security breaches that might entail.
Well, two of the key companies that are involved in actually placing the equipment in the rooms or actually supplying the equipment and the software in the rooms were companies that were originally formed in Israel. They're small companies few people have ever really heard about. But, you know, these are companies that build the facilities, the hardware and software through which millions of communications, American communications, pass. And the NSA uses it to isolate and intercept a lot of these communications or analyze a lot of these communications. So I, in my book, I showed how one of these companies, a company called Barent, for example, which works on behalf of Verizon uses Barent. Few people had ever heard of Barent, yet here it is at the heart of NSA's eavesdropping system, and the people who run it, are people that you have to really wonder about. The chief executive officer of the company is currently a fugitive hiding out in the former chief executive officer, the guy that founded the company, basically, is now a fugitive hiding out in Africa, wanted for theft.
Oh, I thought they caught him. Didn't somebody catch him down there?
Well, not that I've heard. At least it hasn't crossed my desk yet. I don't think they've caught him. Well, they did actually. I mean, they did arrest him at one point in Namibia, the Namibian government, on behalf of a U.S. warrant, and they kept him in jail for a brief time, and then they let him go.
Oh, that's what I was thinking of. I didn't realize he'd been released then, I guess.
Yeah, now he was only in jail for a few days, I think, and then he was released and allowed to return to his house there. He's got lots of money, allegedly embezzled a great deal of money. He's been indicted for all this theft, millions and millions of dollars. And he's kind of using that money to make donations to the Namibian government and so forth to sort of place himself in a good position with the Namibian government so they won't extradite him. So, and then the two other senior executives from the company pled guilty to fraud. Now, these are the people who are running are devising the equipment and the hardware and the software through which a lot of Americans' financial information is passed and personal information. So this is something that Congress has never looked into, the origins of these companies. Who are these people? Where did they come from? Why are we allowing companies that were formed in foreign countries to have play such an intimate role in NSA's eavesdropping? Why doesn't NSA just develop the equipment itself and put it in there? So these are all questions that really the Congress should ask at some point.
Is it just kind of go without saying, do you think, that they have a back door into whatever they want, or it seems like they might?
There's no way
or...
I can tell whether they do. The point is, though, that...
they could.
The point is, why do you have to have a company that had foreign ties, that was formed by people in another country, do such important work? It just doesn't, or such sensitive work, it just doesn't make much sense to me. How many companies are there in the U.S. that could do this? You know, there's a question that you have to raise when NSA does business with companies that have their origins in, you know, foreign countries. And again, Congress pays such little attention to the NSA, especially how it does its job, that I'm not really surprised that, you know, that they haven't paid much attention to this.
Well, you know, Jim, your book ends on a note from Frank Church, who was the senator, who was the chairman of the committee that investigated abuses of the intelligence community back in the 1970s. And it was basically his conclusion way back then, never mind our high-tech revolution we've had since, that the powers of the National Security Agency, if turned against the American people without law, could create a tyranny unheard of, you know, in Orwell's worst nightmares. And then you conclude that the only thing protecting us from that fate at this point is the old law, our Constitution left over from the 1780s, and the laws that, you know, enforce those protections of our rights. Without that, this, they could turn this society into a real nightmare with this kind of ability to surveil people's activities. It translates directly into control at some point, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, the as I mentioned, the watch list before 9/11 was 20 names. Now it's over 500,000. And when Frank Church said those words, and he was very shocked at what he found at NSA, that was back around 1975. That was back before NSA had anywhere near the capability it has now. Back then, the only thing the NSA could do is listen to somebody's hardline telephone and maybe read a telegram or whatever. But today, you know, NSA has the capability to almost get into your thoughts, because if you just think of it, how much of what goes on in your mind or in your personal life is communicated in one way or another, either over a cell phone as you're walking down the street in a car, or on a BlackBerry, an iPhone, or on your computer in emails. All this information that used to be wrapped in envelopes and put in the mail and so forth, letters and that kind of thing, are now open for NSA's analysis because of their access to all the digital media. So whatever was a concern to Frank Church back in the 1970s, you know, it's beyond comprehension what NSA's capabilities are today. And that's why, you know, what's frustrated me a great deal is the fact that when Church created his Senate Intelligence Committee, it was the very first Senate Intelligence Committee, the whole thrust for at least the first 5 or 10 years, or maybe even longer, 10 or 15 years, was to protect the American public from the intelligence agencies. That's the whole purpose of setting it up, was oversight and protection. And but beginning around the 1990s, that emphasis changed. The emphasis is now on protecting the intelligence agencies from the public, basically, and acting as a cheering gallery for the intelligence agencies. The whole protection side, I think, has gone completely out of the window, as we could see during the Bush years. So, so that, you know, all these things, I have no idea what's going to happen during the Obama administration, but these are some of the things I'm hopeful that may get some correction.
All right, everybody, that's James Bamford, author of The Shadow Factory. Before that, A Pretext for War, Body of Secrets, and The Puzzle Palace. And is there an official website for the book, anything like that, where people can look into this a little more?
No, I'm just a one-man band here. I just, you know, it's so hard to...
Well, they can certainly check out the Nova Archive, I'm sure is online, from the special that they did the other night, which, I'm sorry,
yeah,
what was...
if you go to the PBS website and then click on to Nova, you can actually watch the... program that we did last Tuesday was called The Spy Factory.
Mm-hmm.
My latest book is called The Shadow Factory, and the Nova program was called The Spy Factory. And you can actually just watch it online for free. You just click on the link and watch the show. And they actually go good together. I mean, you read the book and then you watch the video, you can see the actual places that I write about. So, again, it's a good opportunity to sort of get an insight into how NSA is going about its secret activities.
Mm-hmm. Well, and people should know that we just barely can scratch the surface in an interview like this. The book is just packed with news-breaking stories, and it's just incredible, mind-boggling stuff when you talk about the level of surveillance and the detail. Really creeped me out, I gotta tell you. It really bothered me when I read it. I'm only getting over it now. That was a few months ago. So, all right. Thanks very much.
Really appreciate it,
Jim.
Thanks for having me on your show.
All right, everybody, I'm going to wrap up Anti-War Radio here, turn it back over to Shauna. I wanted to say, and I didn't get time to cover this, but check out the top of antiwar.com right now, and Jason Ditz has a really great handle on the Israeli elections. He says that Kadima, the party of Tzipi Livni, the current foreign minister, has come out ahead of Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. Although he may have a better chance at forming a coalition, it's up to the president of Israel, Shimon Peres, to decide who gets to form who gets first shot at trying to form a coalition government over there. Anyway, it's a complicated mess, but Jason Ditz has got a really great handle on it and can provide that to you. So please go look at the top headline there at antiwar.com, Livni edges Bibi, but may not get to form government. All right, so tomorrow, Chris Floyd will be on the show, looking at getting some other great guests on you for the rest of the week. So stay tuned. It's Anti-War Radio's back. And regular time, Tuesday through Friday, 1 to 3 Texas time, 11 to 1 out here on the West Coast from Chaos LA Branch. I'm Scott. See y'all tomorrow. But you said I need love. Look, I'm one day.